This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is The Rundown. So often when we talk about racial disparities, it's a black and white conversation. Literally. For instance, a lot of the numbers about inequality with home ownership in this country are between black people and white people. According to a report from the National Association of Realtors, black home ownership was at about 44% in 2022, whereas white home ownership was at about 72%. And these numbers also tend to zoom in on the issue at hand. In this case, home ownership. But the conversation is actually much more complex than just black people, white people, and housing. All of this has implications for the racial gap in wealth in general in this country. Earlier this year, I talked to Marisa Novara. She used to be the Chicago Housing Commissioner, and she said that, yes, black people have some of the lowest home ownership numbers, but that contributes to issues in all of our communities and society at large, not just black people.
When you have those kinds of assets in your life, it gives you way more options and way more ability to care intergenerationally for the well-being of your family and to invest in your community. So when you have the ability to spend money in your community, that benefits, right? All of the small businesses and restaurants and so on in that community. And when you have the ability to pass on assets to your next generation that will help them go to college without a huge load of debt, when you have the ability to help someone buy their own home or pay for their wedding or any of the things that intergenerationally we see folks wanting to do for their children, this is part of a path to that.
Currently, Marisa is the Vice President of Community Impact at the Chicago Community Trust. I'm actually going to be talking to her about all this on a live panel coming up tomorrow at the City Club of Chicago. I'm moderating a discussion with Marisa, Dr. Robert Chaskin from the University of Chicago, and the current Chicago Housing Commissioner, Lisette Castaneda. We're going to get into some innovative strategies to address some of these issues from the standpoint of homeownership in the city. You'll be able to find more information about that in the event description of this episode. But with that panel in mind, I'm going to play you the conversation that Marisa and I had earlier this year. When we talked, she put a lot of this housing and race stuff into the context of building personal wealth and a better society. She says that to get there, we got to first overcome the barriers that have kept so many people out of the housing market. So you recently wrote an article in Crane's Chicago Business about the importance of home ownership. You also talked about the challenges of home ownership, especially for Black and Brown communities, and what we can do here in Chicago to make home ownership more of a reality for people, because it's not really a thing, you know, for a lot of us that may be looking into this right now. First off, I want to get a sense of why home ownership and your explanation is important and valuable.
Homeownership is, I think, matters on a lot of levels. And one is about the ability to really have autonomy and permanency, if that's what you want in a community, right? The ability to say, yes, you know, you don't necessarily control how much your taxes may go up, but you don't have to worry about, you know, a landlord ending your lease, about a rent doubling from one time to the next, or things of that sort. It gives you a sense of permanency and the ability to really put down roots in a community. But it has also been an engine for wealth building for lots and lots of Americans. And that benefit then has translated across generations. When you know, someone builds equity in their home, and they can then use that equity to do things like pay for college, help their children with a down payment on a home. Yeah. It bears out over time. That's been true, though, for primarily white Americans in this country for many decades. It has been much less true and much more complicated for Black and Latinx Americans, unfortunately.
Yeah. We're going to get back to the Black and Latinx families in a second. But first, just a follow up to that. You know, I always just wonder, is at this point, home ownership always a pathway to wealth? I mean, even in times like these when interest rates are so high, right? It feels like renting might be more fiscally responsible sometimes. Like, I personally don't know anyone who's bought a house in my lifetime who now owns that house outright.
So I think you're raising a really important point. And I think that there have been times in this country's history, certainly in the lead up to the crash in 2008, where this sort of mania about home ownership was way overblown. That there are a lot of people for whom the best decision may be for you to rent. And that may be the soundest financial decision and just, you know, your own well-being decision for you. And it might be forever. That's mm-hmm. okay too. It's really about, to me, I want people to have as many choices as possible in their lives about where they can live and about how they can live. And if your choice and your desire is to own a home, I want to make sure that there are as few barriers as possible to that for you. And right now, I think it's what's clear is we have a long ways to go if we're saying we want to, you know, have an equitable playing field for people if they want the choice to do so, to buy a home.
That makes sense. Back to the last point, you write that Black and Latinx families in Chicago own homes at a much lower rate than their white counterparts. Talk about some of the historically racist housing policies that help shape homeownership and what it looks like today.
Yeah, when you go back to, you know, the Great Migration starting in World War I and then beyond, there were practices that were legal at the time, called restrictive covenants, as an example, where if you lived in an all-white neighborhood, in many cases, it was illegal for you to sell your home to a Black person. Mm-hmm. So that set up a whole bunch of restrictions around freedom of movement for people who wanted to buy a home, you know, in various parts of the city. That was ruled illegal by the Supreme Court, which doesn't mean that all the barriers immediately went away. So there were no more restrictive covenants, but what we also saw was then, okay, that morphed into things like selling on contract, which was not in any way a fair and equitable way to provide lending to buy a home.
Could you just give me like a quick sense of like, what does that mean, buy on contract?
So what that meant, and this is the basis for Ta-Nehisi Coates' article, The Case for Reparations. And he, you know, walks through a series of examples in North Lawndale in Chicago on the West Side, which, of course, is not the only place it happened, but was a place of great prominence for it, where because Black people at that time could not get loans, mortgage loans at fair and equitable rates or at all, they would buy a home on contract. So when the mainstream banks wouldn't lend, in many cases, they were forced to buy on contract at exorbitant interest rates and at terms that, for instance, if you miss one payment after could be years and years of payments, you could lose the home. You had none of the protections that came with a standard mortgage loan from an established bank. Then I'll take you up more to the present. Several years ago, BEZ came out with a study about the lending practices of major banks today and found some pretty abysmal findings around, you know, the comparison of, I think it was for every one loan in a majority Black or majority Latinx community, there were four in a majority white community, for instance. So even today, it is much harder to get a loan at favorable terms from a bank if you are a Black or Latinx buyer trying to buy in a majority Black or majority brown community.
Talk about the lasting impact this has on folks when they have all of these barriers historically and even today.
The challenge is that the negatives of everything I just went through does not accrue only to one person. Just as the benefits of homeownership kind of exponentially grow across generations, so do the lack of them. if you did not build wealth in a home and have that money then to save for college for your children, to save for retirement, to help your children with a down payment for their home, the ability to ever do so continues to be a challenge across generations. And that's why it really matters, is that this doesn't just accrue one time.
Yeah.
One other thing just to throw in there about part of why the home buying process is so much more fraught for Black and Latinx buyers is that the appraisal process itself is a whole challenge. And there's been lots of research and lots of mainstream news coverage about a much higher value assigned to a home when the appraiser thought that it was a white family versus a family of color. As a system in and of itself, it is basing the value of a home on what people are willing to pay to live in a community. And so the series of decisions that people make and the values that they place on living in a majority white community as opposed to a majority Black or a majority Latinx community all get compounded into this thing that we then call a comparative or a comp. And that is what decides the value of a home. So it's very hard to disentangle all of the individual decisions that go into that from establishing what's supposed to be kind of a, you know, objective measure. It's not, you know, it is all tied into what people are willing to pay. It's not intrinsic.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's worth us all giving it our best shot.
Let's talk about what can be done here for anyone who wants to get into this housing market as an individual homebuyer. So the city of Chicago is working on some initiatives already, including subsidizing down payments, zoning reforms. Can you tell me about one or two other things that have potential here that have already been really beneficial?
Absolutely. I think one of the things we know to be true is that when it comes to creating affordable new construction housing, the city has a great asset, which is vacant land. A lot of cities don't have that. And the city owns, you know, about 10,000 vacant lots across the city that we can then use to build affordable new construction. And I think what part of the challenge with doing that has been, in order to navigate the system of getting city land from the city, requires moving through multiple departments who all have their own list of rules. And it's been a very cumbersome process. What I'm really excited about is that the mayor's office has come out with a Cut the Tape initiative, which is being led by the mayor's office and is across multiple city departments looking to say, we all have got to reduce the barriers to moving land into the hands of productive use again. I know people in development are really excited about this, and I really commend the city for taking that on.
Nice.
Some of the barriers to home ownership are also exclusionary zoning. And so there are lots of parts of the North Side where the only thing you can legally build in a half mile around a transit stop is a single family home. So in many neighborhoods, that means if your household income is not at least, let's say, $500,000, you can't buy a home near transit. I think that's a loss for communities. I think that's a loss for the city as a whole. And I think that's highly exclusionary.
Yes. I mean, how many of us are making, you know, $500,000?
That's a high, that's high household income.
Yes.
Right. Barrier to break. And it, what it essentially says is, you know, you need not apply.
Yeah.
So in the summer of 2022, the city worked with a whole coalition of folks across the city led by Elevated Chicago to pass the Connected Communities Ordinance. And we made more than a dozen changes to the zoning code to make development near transit more equitable, more dense, more affordable, less parking, lots of really great and important things. And I will say that one of the things we tried to do was to end that ban on anything other than single family homes in a half mile near transit. And we were not able to do it. However, there's a new council now, and I would love to see a return to that issue and to say, it's not to say you can never have a single family home in a half mile near a transit stop. It's to say that doesn't have to be the only thing. And that a three flat in which you know, there's now a chance for people to become a homeowner in a condo will be much, much more accessible to a lower household income than if the only chance is a single family home. And that's something, you know, we would love to really return to see return to and revisit, because I do think it's important for our communities to reflect a range of incomes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So there's buying a home and then there's staying in said home. And yes. I know a lot of your work with the trust is about the latter as well. Can you get into that?
It's so important that we don't just think about home ownership as first-time home buyers getting into a home. And that's, I think, often what we think about. The reality is, though, that we have lots of people living in homes who may desperately need to make repairs to those homes in order to stay there, who may be really capable of continuing to live independently if they had some help with making some adaptations to their homes as they age.
Yes.
Then they could stay in their community and be that, you know, community anchor in their community if they just had some help making some adaptations to their homes. Those are all things I think that the trust is very interested in exploring. How do we better support people once they are in their homes and ensure that we're keeping them there if that's where they want to stay?
Yeah. You talked about this a little bit, just the impact that it can make, you know, on a community for someone to be able to own a home in their space, right, where they want to be, where they have been, and to stay there. When we're thinking about the grander kind of scheme of things, to have that autonomy and access, what does that do for a culture or a society?
I think it's human nature that we all want some degree of certainty and control over our lives, mm-hmm. right? That's what we're moving toward as we reach adulthood and move out on our own, right? That is what that yearning is about. But it doesn't go away when you become a legal adult. It shows up in different ways over time throughout your life. And so just as for some people, they may feel renting is the best thing for me right now, and maybe it always will be. For others, they may reach a point where they say, this is my community. This is where I want to put down roots. And I want to feel some sense of control over the space that is mine. Mm-hmm. And that may come from a series of traumatic things. It may come from not having had the ability to stay somewhere you wanted to stay. It may come from being priced out, you know, whether by rent or indirectly in other instances, and a feeling that I want to provide a level of stability for myself and my family. And that's why if that is where someone has reached in their life, and I think the benefits are immense to them as well as to their community.
Yeah.
And so we all ought to be working to make those options more available to them.
Marisa Novara is the Vice President of Community Impact at the Chicago Community Trust. Marisa, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Erin.
And that's it for today. Thanks to Justin Bull and Sarah Stark for producing The Rundown, and to Ariel Van Clee for editing the show. Brendan Banaszak is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Louis Weeks. The Rundown is produced by WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you later.